At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more. Worried about your future in tech? Master new skills. Accelerate your team's impact and redefine what's possible with Pluralsight. We're more than just another online learning platform. We're shattering the skills gap and shaping future generations of technologists. Transform your work. Transform your team. Ready to tap in? Visit us at Pluralsight.com to learn more.
NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Ahoy, friends. Thank you for tuning into Truth and Justice. You are listening to the Friday follow-up for Season 16, Episode 27, Innocence in Texas. This week, Bob was joined by a team of lawyers from the Innocence Project of Texas, and we got to hear some amazing updates about the Sandy Melgar case, as well as the Jesse Eldridge case. We have a lot to discuss this week, and I'm joined by Bob and Janet, but before we get into that, I think we have some housekeeping.
We do. We just got word, God's honest truth, I don't know if this is good news or bad news, but we have a hearing scheduled for the West Memphis 3 case to test the evidence. It sounds as though Sonia Haygood, the district attorney, scheduled to go before, you know, or they're just going to go before a judge to present the order for the DNA testing to have it signed off on. Hopefully that shakes out and everything's good. It's good there's progress being made. I have a little concern in the fact that it was never, to my understanding, was never part of the agreement that there was going to be a hearing. It was the idea was she was just going to sign the order, send it to the judge to be stamped, and then send it along. So I'm a little concerned that we're going back before that same judge that denied it before to have a hearing. It doesn't sound as though Haygood is going to be disputing, you know, like arguing against the testing, but I don't know. I did see, you know, Damien has had the rug yanked out from underneath him so many times with this. You know, I think he's a little, he's actually not going to the hearing. His attorneys are going. He's not even going to go. But he's a little like, this just makes me nervous. Doesn't, you know, he's concerned about it. I did see Jason Baldwin made a tweet about it, and he sounded much more upbeat about it. He was like, you know, the wheels of justice are finally turning. We have the meeting. And I know his attorneys are also in contact with Haygood's office. So hopefully everything is positive and we're on the up and up. But we'll see. That's July 23rd at 11 a.m. If anybody is in the West Memphis area around that time and is able to go, that's when it's going to be. We'll be sharing more on social media about when it's going to be. I don't think I'll be making the trip down there. Like I said, also Damien's not going. It's not supposed to be some big, as of now, it's not supposed to be some big drawn out hearing where they're going to be, you know, arguing against the prosecutor for DNA testing. It's supposed to be them both going before the judge together. Well, actually, all the lawyers going before the judge together and just saying, we all want this testing. Will you sign off on this? So should
be
okay.
And that's not something where they could spring that on the attorneys. Like, they didn't know that they were suddenly going to have to defend their position, right?
I don't know. I don't think so. Okay. Ryan in the chat just asked, when am I going to get a sit-down interview with Miss Kelly? But that's not going to happen. I've met Jesse a couple of times and talked to him, and he is just very clear. He's not doing any kind of interviews. He has no interest in doing interviews, doesn't want to do an interview. So, yeah, it's not going to happen. I have, like I said, I've spoken with him and have asked him to do an interview, but he's not going to do it. And I don't think he ever has. No one's ever heard from Jesse since he got out in an interview capacity. You got to remember that, you know, the last time somebody sat him down to talk about the case, he ended up in prison for 18 years.
Yeah.
So it's not something that he's going to be doing. But with that being said, we're going to circle back. Just so you guys know, we're going to cover in this one. We have a whole lot of questions. We're going to talk about the updates that we got in this case. I want to talk about this. It feels like old school Serial Dynasty days, but, you know, we're kind of tracking. But Undisclosed is revealing new information. There was a new episode of Undisclosed this week. We're going to chat a little bit about that. All three of us have listened to that episode. And then I'll talk to you about what we got going on this Sunday. And just to remind you guys the timing, we've got this episode this Sunday. Next Sunday, we're going to hear from Amanda Knox. And I believe Christopher Robinson, her husband, is going to be on with. I'm not sure if Chris is going to be on or not. And after that, we're starting season 17. So we're just moving right along. And with that being said, what do you guys think? I probably shared a lot of this with you guys ahead of time, but what do you think about the episode, the things we heard?
It was great to hear from Mike and Allison. Wonderful updates. You know, it was hard because, you know, I've heard the updates before this episode came out. So I was really excited and it was still very exciting, but there's so much more to come and I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, the stuff with Jesse is, I'm super excited to be able to share what's going on with Jesse's case. Janet, your thoughts? I forgot how to make a podcast just now. That just happened.
I definitely enjoyed it. There's some, you know, we've heard from Allison before and I love her and I feel like I have a stronger just familiarity with her and sense of her from more appearances on the podcast. Mike, we haven't heard from quite as much. And there's just something about him that he must remind me of like people in my family who he's Texan. Yeah. I mean, his accent seems straight up Texan. There's just something about him that he just seems like he can hold his own in a room. Do you know what I mean? Like he just seems like so smart and just someone that I would be really happy to have in my corner. I just like him a lot. And so it was great to hear from him. And it was really interesting to hear about Joe David's case, because to your point on the podcast, it was not something that I was familiar with. So it was very cool to get a little sense of all of these other things that we know that Innocence Project of Texas has been working on. And to see those results is it's really encouraging. And it gives me a lot of hope about, you know, outside of Texas, I hope that more innocence projects are really able to, like, you know, make an impact in that way. Not that they're not, but
and a lot of them work so hard, and they're all very limited on resources. But one thing I love about the Innocence Project of Texas is they do not shy away from taking cases that require full. I mean, that's why I have the relationship I have with them, is because, you know, I offer them investigative services. When we do the podcast, you know, we dig in, and not just me, but you guys and all the audience that comes along with that. But yeah, Mike, you know, you mentioned Mike. Mike is really, when it comes down to it, Mike's the reason Ed's free right now. Cause he was, you know, I had a listener that knew Mike when I was covering Ed's case way back in 2016, who had told me, you know, maybe this is a case the Innocence Project will look into. Mike agreed to take a call with me. So he's just like the perfect, Mike Ware is the perfect combination of just incredibly shrewd attorney who can be very blunt and to the point and knows what the hell he's talking about. But he's also like very kind and open-minded at the same time. The fact that you have to remember this is 2016, you know, it wasn't, you know, I didn't have documentaries in 2020 and all that stuff. I was just like some little podcaster from Michigan, and he took the call and everything was just, it was just so like very direct decisions with everything. He was, you know, he's like, well, tell me about the case. I told him about it. And he asked a few questions about it. And he's like, well, I'd have to, you know, in order to do this, we'd have to have all the case documents, trial transcripts and all that stuff. Do you have any of that? And I was like, well, I can go down and get them. He's like, well, do that. I'll just start doing a little more research into it and see what we can do. That's when Mike and I went down to Texas, like within like 3 days after that. And we scanned in all the entire 27 volumes of trial transcripts, all the crime scene photos, all the exhibits, sent those over to Mike, took another call with me. And he had like some, you know, questions about Innocence, about what about this? What about this? What about this? And I had answers for all those things. And he's like, oh, and it was like, so I still remember that call because it was so matter of fact for him. He's like, all right, I'm going to be assigning attorney Allison Clayton to this one, and she's going to be taking it. I'm going to give her your number. Allison will contact you, and let's get moving forward. And like, that was the end.
That's awesome.
And I was like, wait, what do you mean? Like, are you guys like, does that mean you're taking the case? He's like, yes, I am assigning attorney and her students to work on this case. So talk to you later. It was like, that was the end of it. But yeah, so like cool. Mike is the one that got out. But just the fact you got to keep in mind, like how incredible that was for him to like to trust me when he didn't know me, to give us a chance as, you know, as a whole, just the whole Truth and Justice audience and all of us, and to commit resources from IPTX to take on Ed's case. He's just an incredible guy. Like doesn't mess around, doesn't waste time, super kind. Once he's got his mind made up, then he's going to go. I wouldn't want to face off against him in court. I'll tell you that much.
No way.
I've seen him. I've been in a courtroom with him. Nope.
No. I would not either.
Allison either, for that matter.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things I took away from this episode, which I think is fascinating, is the fact that you asked them about their success, and they said they had 40 cases that they were able to get the person out of prison.
Yeah.
Which is phenomenal.
Yeah.
It's also a double-edged sword and scary as hell. The fact that they have had success in 40 cases to get somebody that's been wrongfully convicted. The people that don't think these happen are completely beside themselves. Like 40 times they were able to get somebody out of prison. And that doesn't include everybody else that they haven't.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's amazing that they were able to get 40 people out. But for the people that do not believe in wrongful convictions, it should be a huge eye opener.
Yeah. I mean, that these are all, like you said, just look at our cases. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's a person, there can't be but six people on the planet that think Sandy Melgar's guilty, and those people just hate me.
Yeah.
Yeah. There can't be anybody that thinks Jesse Eldridge is guilty, right? These are very clearly innocent people that are still in prison, that aren't part of that 40 yet.
Yeah.
And so you just think of, like, you start extrapolating that, like, how many innocent. I remember when I first took the case, I talked to somebody at the Texas Department of Corrections, and I remember that them saying, it was somebody from the DOC there that said, you know, they by their estimation, there's probably, they said, about 10% of the people in prison in Texas prisons are innocent. And then I was like, well, how many people is that? And it was like, there's like 1.5 million people or something in prison. I was like, so you guys are kind of acknowledging there's probably 150,000 people in prison just in Texas that are innocent. Like, that's crazy. It was either, I always want to be careful. There's either 1.5 million and it's 150,000, or it was 150,000 and it was 15,000. But whatever it was, I just remember, like, that's insane.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, now 10 years later of working in the criminal justice system and realize, like, I'm sure that number is accurate.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the other thing that I should have said too, they have 40 cases they're successful in. That's just in Texas.
Yeah.
Like, so, oh yeah. It's almost sickening. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's amazing. They're doing amazing work. I'm not taking it away from them. I'm just trying to put out the bigger picture of,
like, sure.
This shit is awful and continues to happen.
Yeah. And you got, that kind of leads us into the discussion about Sandy's case. Cause then you have, like, to understand the burden to make that happen, to get somebody out of prison, is like, look at Sandy's case. Like, there was no case against her. Like, the whole case was smoke and mirrors from the very beginning. They have all this stuff going for them, and she's still there. Like, it is, you know, they call it a Herculean task to, you know, a Herculean burden to get a conviction overturned when somebody is convicted. So the fact that they've been able to do that 40 times is incredibly impressive. But it just, yeah, I mean, look at Jesse's case. Jesse's case was before your time, but Jesse had a bench trial that, if I remember correctly, was like a 2-day trial. It was super quick. There was no evidence. Like, the evidence was his brother testified that me and Jesse went for a jog around the track. He saw this woman. He grabbed her and started attacking her, and Troy ran away. That was it. There was no forensic evidence, no nothing. That was it. And then Troy, then in 2019, says, that was a lie. I lied because the detectives told me, you know, and keep in mind, this was, I think, 7 years after the fact. He'd been interviewed for years on and on and on, and always told them, like, I have no idea. I don't know. I mean, Jesse was home with me that day. I don't know what was going on. Like, I don't know why you keep bothering me.
Mm-hmm.
And then they told Troy, which I had found in a document that on a report that, or a transcript or something, that they had told Troy that they found his DNA on Kiao Gove's body. And they told him, like, either you're going down for this, because there's only two explanations for this. Either you killed her, or you were there when your brother killed her. And then that's when he ended up flipping on his brother. And then later we found out that it wasn't true at all. There was no DNA for either one of them on the scene. But yeah, point being, you know, the one piece of evidence against Jesse was his testimony. He turns around and says it's a lie. The Conviction Integrity Unit, the prosecutor's office, takes him and gives him multiple polygraphs. He passes them all like he's telling the truth now. That was absolutely a lie back then. 6 years later, Jesse's still in prison, still cranking along the wheels of justice.
Well, and these are the cases, and you know, we talked about it with Ed, and understanding that there is this other, there can be for people on the prosecution side, this floating fear of, oh, crap, even if we agree and know that this was a total miscarriage of justice, like, how much money is this going to cost us if we get to the point where this person can receive some sort of compensation, which is kind of a joke word. But you take, you know, certainly this is true for Jesse. But again, I think many of us feel especially strongly about Sandy, specifically because of her health and the fact that she was already part of a vulnerable population, you know, when she went in. And then we had this pandemic. And everyone deserves a giant pile of money who is wrongfully convicted. But if I were Texas, I would be scared to death that if Sandy is exonerated, you know, if Sandy's conviction is dropped and she can be proven factually innocent, I would just give her all the money, just all the money. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, because it makes you so angry. And it's like, she's not out of the woods yet, you know? And there have been so many situations in which, like, we could have lost that person. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's just like, it's well, so infuriating.
On top of that, besides her health issues and everything she's dealt with in court, I mean, any situation, any wrongful conviction is horrible. Anyone who loses a loved one, it's horrible. The fact that Sandy did both.
Yes.
Like, she lost her husband,
yes,
the love of her life, who had one of the most beautiful relationships,
yes,
that I've ever even heard of from anybody, and then got sent to prison for it.
Mm-hmm.
And for Liz, who, you know, Liz lost her father and then lost her mother,
yeah,
on top of it. Like, it's horrific. It's absolutely horrific. They all are, but it's just, to me, it's just one of the worst.
Yeah.
Well, the idea, too, that they might be able to get a bail hearing to get her out,
oh,
so that
that
they can
was...
fight this from home is phenomenal.
I didn't even know that was a thing. I thought that could only happen.
Mm-hmm.
That was such a cool, I mean, it was, again, because we're sort of conditioned not to hope too much. I was like, as soon as I heard that, my heart just soared. And then I felt myself pressing it back down to earth. Like, don't get excited.
Yeah.
Don't get excited. But that would be huge.
Yeah, I think in most states, any state, like, I've never heard of this. Usually it's like in Adnan's case. Once they overturned his conviction, or and by saying that, we have to remember, we always say exonerate over, but generally what happens is a new trial is ordered.
Right.
Which means you're back in pretrial, which is usually when you're in jail. And at that point, then you can get bail while you're waiting for your new trial. I've never heard of, like, while we're working through this process, but while the conviction still stands, that she could get bail from prison, or at least it's a possibility, that would just be absolutely incredible. And
yeah,
and from the evidence that they've found so far, like I don't know how she's not. I'm very encouraged by the fact that Mike said that the person in the Conviction Integrity Unit in Harris County that's working with him is very open-minded, former defense attorney that's working with them. Sounds like they're, you know, they're not fighting against them. They're working with them. Because, I mean, give me a break. You have none of this evidence.
Break.
And you have DNA on the murder weapon and on that stool that had blood on it that matched each other. You have a foreign person's DNA on Sandy's bindings, which Colleen Barnett claims she tied herself up with. Well, then whose DNA is on those bindings? And hopefully the DNA, the testing of this hair, comes through and we get some positive results from that. Like at what point do you just let her go?
Yeah.
Like, this is ridiculous.
Yeah. Where's old Colleen these days? Please don't tell me she's a judge. I can't remember.
I don't know. I believe she's, I don't know. I feel like I remember her losing her job at Harris County at some point after the podcast aired. my brain's telling me she's a realtor now, but I don't know that that's true. I don't know why I think that.
Yeah. Maybe she writes totally unrealistic mysteries on the side that everyone reading them would go, well, this is stupid.
Right. That doesn't make sense.
I don't need to finish this book. This is stupid.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, no, that was very encouraging. It was great. It was great. And also to be reminded, you know, as Mike is receiving this award, and that there is a community of people, because it can feel so hard and, you know, feel hopeless, I'm sure, at times when you just feel like it is this Herculean effort and it may not work out. And so to know that there's a group of people that are all supporting each other in this work, you know, it must just make all the difference in the world to have somebody who's like, brother, I've been there. Sister, I've been there. You know, like, it's hard. Yeah. There's a lot that doesn't work out, but when it does, it's all worth it.
Realtor.
She is a realtor. I wasn't wrong.
She's great.
The prosecutor that put Sandy Melgar in prison is now a realtor.
I'm so happy that she's a realtor. I'm so happy she's doing anything else.
Right. But also, just tells you how good she was at her job.
Yeah.
That now she's a realtor.
Why would I sell you a house that doesn't have a floor? That doesn't make sense.
Right. Of course it.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm just being a bully. But if there's one person in the seasons that you've had across all seasons, I'm pretty comfortable making fun of her. I just can't help it. I can't help it. I had to get that out of my system. Anyway, exciting, hopeful. I guess we see what happens next. Especially with some of the cases where we couldn't quite hear everything. And hopefully we'll be able to hear more very soon. What's happening? Everybody's looking at something.
Sorry.
And none of it is the podcast.
Hold up her Instagram.
Yeah. Says former Texas prosecutor, Houston realtor, and Mexican food aficionado. If anybody wants to know what makes Colleen Barnett tick.
Cool.
All right. I know we don't have a lot of questions. Do we have any questions?
Yeah. So we have from... Ellen says, you probably don't know the answer to this, but it certainly got my attention. Did I understand correctly that the new to us case of Joe David Padron, another man, Robles, received the death penalty in 2011 for that same crime? Is it believed that he was the real killer? Do we know?
I talked about that with Mike a little bit. And yeah, if I remember correctly, the guy that got the death penalty, there was a group of people that committed this crime. And that was part of how they got Joe David out, was somehow or another they got coerced into pushing with jailhouse informants or whatever, like lumping Joe David in with that group. And it sounds like they're some of the people that were in that group that got convicted. Yes. And so, because that was the other thing, it's coming back to me as I'm talking.
Mm-hmm.
There was four people that committed the murder. They arrested and convicted Joe David and that other guy.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the things Mike said was the prosecutor's office never seemed to have any inclination to even find who the other two were. And Joe David wasn't one of them. But it sounds like the one guy was, and that there was two or three other people that committed the crime with him. Joe David wasn't one of them. So, yeah, I believe that he was actually guilty of the crime, the one that's in there now, or at least believed to be. But there are still at least two other people at large that they've just never bothered to pursue.
Okay, well, Kathy says, let's see. Well, yeah, Kathy's just, you know, very, very much in touch with Jesse. And so she's just kind of speaking for him that things are not great because there are other bad actors in the prison that he's in and they're getting in trouble, which, as we know from other cases and other conversations we've had, can end up meaning that everyone in a certain cell block or anyone in a certain area is punished alongside them. So there will be lockdowns. And that's also got to be so hard and so frustrating, is that there are all these situations in which you can kind of, quote unquote, play by the rules, even though you know you shouldn't be there at all. But you kind of have to be playing by the rules in order to, you know, not make it harder for yourself to get out. And then other people are doing something and you just end up on lockdown anyway. That's got to be incredibly hard.
And what's really frustrating about it is what's going on in Jesse's prison is, I believe it's, again, this, because this used to happen in Ed's prison all the time, too, is that I think they call it K2, that, like,
synthetic marijuana. Yep.
And which causes people to just absolutely go berserk. The inmates are using that. And every time somebody gets caught with it or using it, they put everybody on lockdown, which means no phone calls, no visitors, no nothing. They're just completely locked down.
Yeah.
But the more for us, I still remember... I so vividly talking to Ed about that one time, just saying like, man, it's crazy. There's so much drug use that goes on in prison. And I said, like, how does it get in there? And he was like, how do you think? And I'm like, I don't know. Like, how are those guys getting it in there? He's like, well, it ain't the inmates bringing it in.
Yeah.
It's the guards. So there are guards that, because that's the only way for it to get there. They get literally, if there's a contact visit in Texas prisons, I could go visit Ed and he'd get searched and stuff come out, but it was behind glass. Not glass like you see on TV with the little telephones. The prison Ed was in, at least, it was like a grate. You know, mm-hmm. There was like glass and kind of like chicken wire where you can just talk through it in the little bay, but you can't touch them, right? You can't pass anything to them. They can't do any of that. If they have an actual contact visit, so like when Kim and the kids would go visit Ed, because for family, they could do contact visits where they could actually sit in a room with them. Mm-hmm. When we did that, Ed would have to be completely strip searched before and after, before those meetings. You know, and so what he said, he's like, there's literally only one way for the drugs to get into the prison, and it's the prison guards bringing it in.
Mm-hmm.
So the prison guards bring it in to the inmates, they abuse it, and then all the other inmates get locked down because of it. That's one thing. How can they not find a way to put a stop to that?
Yeah. You need guards for the guards. That's a sad
Yeah, I actually
state.
Just wrote a paper on this for one of my criminal justice classes that they were. It was just interesting because I was just, you know, hearing about what was going on in Jesse's case, and the prompt that we were kind of writing about was, you know, people who suffer from drug addiction, you know, if we should be funneling them into the prison system or if we should be finding another route. And part of the argument I made in mind was, you know, aside from all the other reasons, I said it would be one thing if the prison system was a place to rehabilitate them for that.
Right.
But the fact is, if you take somebody who struggles with drug use, and then you put him into a place that's full of drugs, how is that? That's not going to help. It's only going to make the problem worse. And I kind of cited this situation that's going on down in Jesse's prison right now.
Yeah.
The guards bring the drugs in.
Ugh, yeah. Well, that is what we have for this week's episode, but happy to talk a little bit about Undisclosed and what's going on.
So if any of you aren't following Undisclosed, let me do this, because I know there's some people that aren't following Adnan's case and Undisclosed.
Yeah.
So I'm going to tee up now what we got coming up Sunday.
Great.
So you guys don't have to stick around till the end of this conversation before we do that. The good news is this Sunday, you're going to hear from Ed Eight and Allison Clayton again, 2 weeks in a row. The bad news is it's not for a good reason. If you guys remember back in the fall, I remember I flew down to Texas to film TV project about Ed's case. And all I had told you back then was, when we got down there, it was a shit show. There were some very unethical things happening. And to the point where we walked out, neither Allison and I would sign off releases on our interviews. I actually pulled Ed out in the middle of his interview. We were both at the airport. It's a whole thing. We explained it all on the episode on Sunday. But it just happened to be because they actually tried to keep me and Allison apart. But her flight got delayed. We ended up at the airport at the same time. And I shared with her what was going on that Ed had told me. And it was like frantic calls to Ed and Kim, and literally had Kim like walk into the room, grab Ed and pull him out and walk out of it. When I came back, that's all I shared about it, was because, you know, Allison had filed a cease and desist letter to the network telling them you violated this, and this. You will not air any part of this, or there will be legal actions, da 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 da. And we never heard another word. We thought that was the end of it. And then this Saturday, Ed texts me a promo that A&E was putting out for the show with his name on it, that's going to be coming out soon.
You've got to be kidding me.
No. So I'm going to read, because I wasn't planning on this, but it just happened to be sitting right here. But so if you want an idea of what's coming up on Sunday, in Allison's cease and desist letter, in one of the last paragraphs Allison wrote, said, "As you might imagine, none of us will be signing anything. If this project continues, Mr. Ruff and I will exhaust every resource to expose and hold A&E accountable for this production, which has devolved into fraudulent, gotcha-style television that preys on some of society's most vulnerable members." So I went back and reread that and called Allison and said, you know, it says that we're going to exhaust every resource to expose them. So let's expose them. So Sunday's episode is me, Allison, and Ed walking through every single thing that they did and also telling you how the story, you know, telling you how their episode ends and exactly what the show is, because it's a piece of shit is what they're making. So that's what's coming up on Sunday, is you're going to hear that whole story. And I do suspect we have to wait until after it airs to know what all they're putting out, to see if there will be legal action afterwards. Because, you know, one thing is they interviewed both me and Allison. And then, as you know, Jana, from working in that industry, you have to sign a release to allow them to use it. Well, the nice thing is the dipshits that were making the show didn't have assigned the releases before the interview.
Yeah.
And so then they were scrambling after the interview to have us sign it. And we both refused to sign it. Ed refused to sign some stuff. So some of the releases for him. So we're kind of waiting to see, are they going to air my interview without my permission?
Wait a minute. Yeah. What if we can turn this into getting Ed and Kim a bunch of money from a network that we sue?
Right. That's
let's sue. Yeah.
Very possible.
Let's get him a bunch of money, everybody. We'll pay for the lawyers. Yeah. We'll pay for an entertainment lawyer that can work with Allison and Ed, and like who knows exactly what to do and exactly how to suck as much money out of A&E, and shame on them.
Yep.
I think I think that it's going to be a blessing in disguise, because I think that all the money that we all want Ed to get from somewhere is going to come from those idiots. I'm excited.
Yeah. I hope
I'm
so.
Excited.
Like I said, we're just waiting for the bitch of it is for us to find out what they did. We have to watch it when it airs.
I'm so sorry about that.
Because we don't know what they're because we've been racking our brains, like, what could they put together? Like, they can't use my interview. They can't use her interview. They can't use anything filmed at Ed's house. They can't, which was a large majority of what they did. Like, there's all these things, like, what do they have left? And so we're real, obviously, pretty curious about how they're going to piece this thing together. I'm hoping what they don't do is that A&E is like, oh, we got deep pockets. Fuck it. Let's just air the whole thing. And if they do, they're going to be paying.
I just don't think they have deep pockets. I mean, nobody does right now.
Yeah.
We're going to find, you know what? We're going to find out how deep their pockets are, because we're going to empty them.
Yeah, we'll find out. I'm at least taking some solace in the fact that, as I know from someone who spent a year producing a documentary and then waiting, and how hard it is to keep everything secret so that everything is you know, a big surprise when the show comes out. I'm really taking some solace in the fact that everybody's going to know everything that's going to happen on it before it ever even airs.
Great.
Because one thing I did not sign also is an NDA.
Yeah.
None of us did. So for those of you that are just Truth and Justice folks and have, obviously Ad Non's case is part of ours, but if you're not following Undisclosed and you're not interested, you can turn it off. You're not going to miss anything else. I just real briefly want to touch on, so this week's episode of Undisclosed, they really dug into who we used to refer to as Mr. S, Alonzo Sellers. And they broke down, there was a profiler and a group of investigators that looked into the case that had some pretty interesting theories about Sellers. I actually talked quite a bit about it with Rabia yesterday.
Oh, you did? Okay, cool.
Yeah, she had asked me. We disagree on some of the
importance
of it. Okay. We were just, you know, because she asked me to listen and tell me what you think. So essentially, you need to go listen to the episode on Undisclosed to hear like the whole thing, but a real, since we're already 35 minutes in here. You know, essentially, the theory is that whoever killed Hay, because it's always been a mystery. How did Mr. S know her body was there?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that was always such a weird thing, and his story never made sense. And I agree, it still doesn't make sense. The theory they came up with is that whoever killed Hay didn't bury her body, but just dumped her body behind the concrete barriers right there and took off, and that Mr. S came across it, found it, and due to some of his criminal history, he has, you know, he was a streaker, there's sexual assaults, there's a lot of things in there. They feel that it's possible that he on multiple occasions would return to Hay's body to spend time with it. That's all more I'm going to get into it. And that would, you know, that he would cover her up and then come back and then cover her up. Before I share my opinion, what did you guys think about that part of it?
Well, I'll go real quick, because obviously we all know that I don't know a lot about this case. I literally came in and listened to it and I asked you, I'm like, is this new? Is this, I don't know anything about this.
Yeah.
It's very interesting take. I feel like there's a lot of moving parts to it though that I don't fully understand, which is why I would totally lean on whatever you suggested, because there's just, in my opinion, there's too many moving parts for that scenario to kind of work itself out like that.
Well, and on that regard too, like what I was just telling Robbie when we were talking yesterday too, is that like I'm not, I mean, I'm an amateur. This is a, you know, so it's just, you should, no one should just be like, well, Bob thinks this, so that's so, you know, because the profiler that I, from what I understand from Robbie, it wasn't actually her theory. It was somebody else in the group's theory, but, mm-hmm. but she, you know, was helping break it down and believes it too. So, you know, it could be anything. Before I go on, what did you think, Janet?
I was fascinated. Obviously, it's a very disturbing thought. I agree that there are questions. There are still questions that I don't think they plan on kind of breaking that down in terms of like a hypothesis in a future episode about how it would have worked with Mr. S finding the body. But I did think it was very, because when and because how, and just sort of wondering about that stuff. By the way, the connection to the Keepers and that detective was really, really interesting.
Yeah,
I want to
talk about that too in a minute.
But I did think, my first thought when I heard that was, again, not that I'm necessarily like, yes, 100% that's it. And I don't even know if anybody is 100% that's it. But I did think, interesting, because a lot of the time when people tell a lie, you know, that you just sort of try to figure out what might be, that's like, what really happened? And then how do I turn that into something that it sounds more plausible that I could tell other people? And the idea of him actually, yes, like stopping to pee somewhere, or like, you know, that there could be a way that he found her for the reason that he said, but like it didn't happen then, and it didn't, and that's not the action he took after that. I don't know. I was just sort of thinking like, well, maybe part of his story is true. Like he did stop to pee there one time at night or whatever, and yeah. he did make this discovery, and then he did, if he did what he did, that then when the time comes and you make the decision, like, okay, I'm going to come forward about this. But why would you come forward about that? I guess I just, right. yeah, I'm just, I have questions, but, and I hadn't thought that much about it other than listening to it and being really interested to talk about it with you guys.
Yeah. So this is what I told her. The one thing where Robbie and I kind of have a disagreement about, and it is, as she said, it's just kind of semantics how we're saying it. Because one issue I had was for that theory to play out, Sarah, the investigator that was sharing the information, it said that, you know, that Hayes' body wasn't buried. It was just kind of covered up. And I understand that most of you listening have not seen these photos. I don't know if you were, if, I think Zach's seen them.
Yes.
Jan, I don't know if you've ever even seen the crime scene photos. Have
yeah.
you?
Yeah.
You have? Yeah. To me, she was very much buried. I think she was, in my opinion, the way it looked. Now, it was, it gets complicated because it's not like there was a big, deep grave and she was buried into it. There was already a depression there.
Right.
But so she's on her side. And kind of what I explained to Robbie, like there was, to me, like there was a significant amount of dirt from the way I see it, because of the fact she's on her side and her, you know, both shoulders are underground, like in the front, like a little bit of her hair sticking up and some of the fingers from her right hand are sticking up. The rest is all under dirt. So you take like the width of a person's body, there's that much dirt, right? So it's not like a little bit. Same thing with her hips, although her left hip was exposed a little bit. But that means from right hip up to that point was covered in dirt. And then there's a little bit of her leg and the part of her foot. But there was, like, to me, like, she was buried in dirt. That was where we talked about, like, it wasn't, like, I think Robbie put it best. She said it's kind of semantics. We're both kind of, like, we just both have a different view on what's buried, what's not buried. But the way I heard the theory was that she was just, like, thrown into the, like a depression and just, like, some dirt and leaves scooted around her to kind of cover her up. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like she had to be excavated in the photos when she was pulled out of there. So that was part of my thing, was in order for that to work, she has to be able to easily accessible. But well, the things that I pointed out, sorry, go ahead, Janet.
Well, I guess I'm just wondering, how much could a person tell, how much could that excavation and forensics process determine about how, like, I guess what I'm saying is, if he makes the decision to come forward, then he's the person who can make the decision as to how he would like her to be found. So is there an indication when you're removing this, if they were in roughly the same place, would it, how would they be able to tell if she hadn't been like, yes, in that place, but more recently more carefully buried? Or was it like packed to where it was like, oh, this has to have been like this for X amount of time? That's my question.
And that's the trouble, is we don't really know. We have some photos. It would be better if there was a video where you can see. Because it, to me, it just, and again, that's all, just like the way it looked to me was like it had to be dug up, like that ground was compacted. And also, we look at the autopsy, and Dr. Lavardi's take on it was that she believed that Hay was buried within like 24 hours when she was killed, because there's things that there's no animal predation, there's no even though it was cold, this stuff still happens. There was no insect activity, there was no slippage on the skin, or if she was out exposed to the elements for say a month before she was, you know. So I like took that into account. Yeah. Like I just don't, but then there's other things, you know. I kind of went through with Rabia, to me, like the behaviors that don't make sense. Like it doesn't add up to me that if that's what Sellers was doing, going back and forth, then he's gonna be like, well, now I'm going to bury the body, really risk putting my forensic evidence all over it. And I agree with her, like, unfortunately we don't know if he left any forensic evidence on it, because nothing's ever been tested against him. So that's one thing to keep in mind. But then like bury it and then go say I found it, when really you could just, no one's at that point, no one's found her for 28 days, like just go away, you know. I don't understand like the idea, like the behavior of then like I'm gonna bury her and then go report that I found her is an odd behavior. But there's other things too. You know, they were talking about the fact that her shirt and skirt were pulled up, and what that's called is peakerism behavior that we look at. A lot of time you see that with young men. All these things are just probabilities. You know, when you're doing a behavioral analysis, you that's one behavior that you tend to attribute to like younger men will do, where they'll, you know, after a body is a person is deceased, where they'll, you know, pull their clothes up and things like that. But to me, and you guys have seen the photos, I don't think this is peakerism for a couple of reasons. One, you do have the shirt pulled up and her breasts are, and bra and her breasts are exposed, and the skirt is up, but her pantyhose and her underwear are still on. And I don't think that if we're looking at peakerism, that would be the case. I think if they're going to do one, they're going to do the other. I don't think they pull the skirt up and then leave.
Well, I don't know.
Thick white pantyhose and underwear.
You would know better than me. To me, it's such an aberrant behavior that if someone has a proclivity towards a certain body part and not another, I just don't know. I mean, if they're not doing anything active anyway, or if I do that, I mean, this is so hard to talk about for me. But if it's like, I don't want to risk doing something that would like is like making a bargain with yourself. Like, I'll just do this, because if I do this other thing, I might do this other thing after that, and then that would leave DNA and da da da. Like, I just don't know. It's so far afield from the way my own brain works, and from really anything I've, you know, listened to or read, you know, that
any
I just
clear thinking individual would think the whole thing is obviously awful.
Right.
But I hear you. Yeah, for me, like my only understanding is just from the stuff I learned from Jim over the years and stuff, is like when you're looking for like peakerism stuff, you often will find a body when, because all these behaviors that go into a profile are based on like thousands of case studies, right? And what Jim always talked about is a lot of times when you see where like the shirt will be pulled up, the pants will be, but you'll find a body with the breast exposed, the pants pulled down. Oftentimes those offenders end up being young males, because it's, you know, they there's something with that level of peakerism tends to lean that way. So, with that caveat, anybody can do anything, right? Anything's possible. But to me, I've always thought, and I still believe, there's a reason why I've always said, I think there's one person that killed her, and then they had help from someone else to bury her, mm-hmm. which are really, you know, the state's theory is not that far off in that regard, as far as, you know, except for they pulled Jay Wilde in, and I believe 100% Adnan's innocent. But I say that because this is clearly a personal cause homicide. I believe that Hay was killed because something happened between her and somebody else that incited some kind of rage. But then I believe the person that helped bury her, that probably that was the primary, you know, the leader of the burial, I think it's an older person. I don't think it's two teenagers. I think it was, you know, maybe, you know, a younger person that killed her. But from my own personal profile, I believe that we're looking at a much older, more mature, more sophisticated person that did the burial. Is I say that because you have this personal cause homicide, but then her body, the way I see it, the way I've reconstructed the crime scene in my mind, was not treated with any care whatsoever when she was dumped there. And part of that for me was the clothing. So to me, the shirt and bra being pulled up and the skirt coming up are the result of her being dragged. Now, I don't think she was dragged 120 feet from the car to the grave, because there would be evidence
right,
of that.
Right.
But what I think happened, my personal theory is that two people carried her. One person held her by the feet, and one person had their arms under her, like armpits, carrying her. And that act alone can cause your shirt and bra to scoot up like that. If you're holding somebody, I've just seen it just from, like, you know, in fire department carrying people like that, it causes that to happen.
Okay.
So that's just personal experience.
Including the bra?
Not necessarily the bra, but I think that she's probably, and that's what I mean, it was very impersonal once her body was there. I think if she's then dropped on the ground, the hole is dug, cleaned out, and then she's drugged just a couple of feet back to the hole, you know, from the feet, I think that could have been what pulls the bra up, that pulls the skirt up, leaves the pantyhose down. And then I've talked about this year in years past, the positions of her arms. You know, you have her right arm crossed in front of her chest, and then her left arm bent back just like that, but behind her back. To me, that looks like she was rolled, like the body was rolled into the hole, which is completely, which is, again, to me, not consistent with the same person that had enough of a personal relationship with her that the homicide happened to begin with. It's more consistent with somebody else that's just like, all right, we just need to get this done, rolled her into the grave, and then buried her.
I mean, you know how tight pantyhose are? They're so tight. Like, they just don't.
They were still up.
Okay. I thought you were saying, I thought I heard you say the pantyhose roll down. I thought you just said that. And I was like,
no, if I did, I misspoke. No, the skirt was pulled up. Like,
right.
If you were drugged by the foot, the cotton, the pencil skirt type thing she was wearing was pulled up, but the pantyhose and they were more like, they weren't leggings, but they were thicker stockings.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's just always what it looked to me. So, and just to explain why I don't agree with kind of the theory, because to me, like, that's what I see when I see the condition of the clothing and all that stuff. I don't see it as, I've never saw it and thought peakerism. It just doesn't, it didn't ever tract with me. And then the idea we've heard over and over again from Jim, and they mentioned Jim, like, the only person that would bury the body like that is if they had a personal connection to a known personal relation to the victim, and if the victim was connected to the location where they were killed, that's the only reason they're going to spend that kind of risk and time with the body to move it and bury it. I don't see if it's Alonzo Sellers, it's completely disconnected from the murder, just finds the body there, like going through, like he could have accomplished the same thing by say, and actually it would have been more believable if he had walked back and her body was just laying in the, you know, laying out in the woods, and he's like, hey, I found a body here. The fact that it was, you know, as concealed as much as it was, and he found it, it made his story less believable, the fact that she was buried. But again, I just want to preface that. Same thing I told Robbie was, Robbie and I rarely disagree, but we disagreed. We went back and forth like three times, like, but are you sure you don't see?
Well, I think the one thing that I heard that gave me pause in the whole theory, and it's not to say it's not right or what, but the one thing that gave me pause was the idea that the perpetrator would have dumped the body because this area was secluded, but not so secluded that they couldn't be caught with the body.
Right.
So, okay, I understand that. But then you're saying a second individual would take the time to spend time with the body.
That's a good point, yeah.
In the same area that is so not secluded enough that they can't be caught. The first individual can't be caught.
Right.
So why would a second individual who actually has nothing to do with it
take that risk? Yeah, a good point.
That's a good point, too. Well, what about this? Is there value in, even if you don't believe the full extent of the theory, do you think there could be value in Sarah saying, you would not park your car right here, that's bad, that maybe you stop for a second, you do temporarily place the body behind the concrete barriers, and then you hike back, you too quietly sneak back up there and very quietly, knowing that now there's no indication that you exist on the road itself. Then you take care of the rest.
Yeah, I think that's very plausible. Like, I think it makes a lot of sense to, you know, throw the body behind the barrier, go drive, go park somewhere else, and then come back and bury it. But I also think, like, at night, I've been there, you know, 120 feet back in those woods. If you don't have a car on the road, nobody's going to see you back there. I think,
you can
see a car. Yeah,
I mean, that's why you would do that, right?
Yeah, you could see a car coming from long enough away that you could, you know, hide behind a tree or whatever while you're waiting for the car to pass. Yeah, so I don't, and I don't know how heavily trafficked it is or was back then. I've been there twice, and in both occasions spent, you know, one time over an hour there, and like not a single car drove by at the time. But that's, you know, it's all anecdotal, because I keep hearing that, and Grayson's in the chat and he lives in the area, said that, you know, you'd be noticed on that road. Yeah, so I'm sure that's true. I was just, from my own experience, I know it's like we were parked there the whole time and it was like not even a car drove by.
But you would feel very exposed if you had done something horrible and knew that your car was now essentially signposting where you were now doing the next thing.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons
versus you go away and you're like, okay, now we sneak back and it's just us and we can hide behind a tree.
It's one of the millions of reasons I don't believe Jay's story, because for exactly that reason. Like,
yeah.
You're not going to be sitting there with your car parked out there while you're back there burying it. You're inviting, especially a cop driving by it, to be like,
you're not supposed to park here. And what are you doing?
Why is this person here in the middle of the night? Right. This place where people dump bodies all the time. I'm going to go investigate. Yeah, I very much think that probably her body was dumped out over there by the, and it's probably why that location was chosen. When I drove there, it was like, that was the first spot. If you're coming from the one direction to where you could pull off, the barriers are there. You could drop the body, drive away, go park somewhere else, and then, you know, walk back or have somebody drop you off or something.
But I don't remember us ever talking about that before, which is why it was such a revelation to Robbie. Just the idea of like, oh, the body would have just been put here at all. Like that, I didn't remember, that felt like new information to me. Like the idea of how did they get the body all the way back there? I just didn't remember anyone saying like, well, they probably essentially first hid her body right off the road and then left and then came back. I just didn't remember that. But if that was already out there, then I guess that's not a revelation.
I don't know that it was out there, but it like that, I guess what I'm saying is that makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense to me that a car would be parked there. And the last thing I know, the other big reveal there was, and I knew this a long time ago, cause I know Shane Waters, and he had told me about this a long time ago. The former Baltimore detective that they were calling Deep Throat that had told the person from the Keepers this whole story about how Sellers had come to him, told him he found the body, they were interrogating him. And then while they're interrogating him, and he tells them that he saw the boyfriend and his buddy bury the body or take the body back there. That's how he knew where it was. And then they said that, you know, the boyfriend confessed in the middle of it. So then they left it out. I don't believe a word of it. I think that the woman, Miss X, they were calling her.
Mm-hmm.
I believe her,
right?
That this Deep Throat guy told her that. I do not believe his story. And, you know, I told Robbie too, I was like, the thing is, like, I get how you can be like, well, maybe there's some truth in there, or what can we pull out? But there's too much of that story that is provably false for me to be, for just the way I operate, I can't then pick through and be like, but this sounds legitimate. You know, it's like, like you said, first of all, he would have no way of knowing it was a boyfriend or his friend who was doing it. You have the supervisor at the college that says that, you know, he came to him and told him, and then they called the police and they went down. But this guy's story is that he went to him and he was being interrogated about it. But like, so then what do you do with that? Nobody ever confessed. Right. Like none of that story adds up to me.
I didn't know what to make of any of that.
I have no idea who this guy is. But to me, it feels to me like a guy that was like, and I have no idea who this guy is, but like when I was just seeing all the things that are absolutely not true about that story, I'm like, oh, this is a guy that's just like talking. He's heard Serial, knows enough about the case that he thinks he knows what happened. And he's like, oh yeah, I know what happened because I taught, you know, the guy confessed to me and that's how they did, you know, that's what it felt like to me, because he made it seemed very much like that narrative is something somebody who is vaguely familiar with the case,
right,
thinks they know what they're talking about. You know, they know that the ex-boyfriend and his friend were convicted. Maybe they think he confessed, you know, whatever the thing is. But I don't know. What did you guys think about that whole situation.
So you're saying that none of it is true. Like, you imagine that it's possible that, like, Sellers didn't even have a relationship with this man at all. Like, that is all so far off from being true that he literally made up the part from whole cloth of, like, oh yeah, I know Sellers. He actually came to me about this, and I did it up, or that.
Well, it's more so that I don't care.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? It's like, I'm sure he did have a relationship with Sellers, or maybe knew him, or, you know, probably. I don't know. But when he tells a story that is absolutely not possible to be true,
right?
Then and that's kind of what I was talking about. Where, like, I think a lot of people are like, well, but this part of it might be like, I can't. The whole, like, there's too much of it that's bullshit to be like, but I believe him on this part.
Right.
It's just like, to me, I have to just write the guy off completely because.
And remind me, what did he provide? He was called Deep Throat. Why? What information did he provide in the Keepers?
I don't know that he provided anything into the Keepers, but he told this story to Miss X from the Keepers.
I thought he was called Deep Throat because he's referenced in the Keepers, and I just don't remember.
Yeah, that was the way they kept his anonymity in the Keepers.
He did help. Oh yeah, he was helping to try to right a wrong or something.
Oh yeah, yeah, you're right. Yeah,
I guess I was just saying that because I was trying to give, you know, you sort of don't know. The problem with Baltimore's history with the cops is that you don't know how much credibility to give to any one of them, oftentimes because they don't have a great reputation.
Right.
In terms of the past and that era and what we know about, you know, McGillivray and all those people.
Part of it is, the strange to me is just the timeline of it, because the Keepers was like in 1969 or 1970. So if he was a detective or supposed to be part of that case then, I don't understand the connection.
Well, like, but the whole thing wasn't exposed then, right? Wasn't it exposed much later?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I guess so. But
yeah, so I think now that you're refreshing my memory, I think that he was one of the detectives, like, years later when, like, people started coming forward that was involved with it.
Okay.
Yeah, because otherwise he'd be like 80 years old.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I was like, I felt like there was way too much of a lapse in time there.
Yeah. I don't know. Like I said, I just, for me, when I heard it, it was just like, well, that can't be true. That is, they're explaining it. Like, when Shane explained it to me years ago, it was just like that, but that's not possible. None of that's possible. So I had heard about it a long time ago and was just like, that's like, I never even reported on it because it was like, no, it's not credible to me.
Yeah.
You know, I'd want to, but then the other piece of it is that, you know, everything we're getting third hand hearsay. You know, I heard it from Shane, who heard it from Miss X, who heard it from him.
Right.
You know, Robbie and Sarah heard it from her, who heard it from him. So it's you know, it's a game of telephone too. So it could be something as simple as Miss X misremembered what he told her, and maybe he's like, so I don't want to say like this guy is full of shit. I just like the version of the story we're hearing, I don't buy it at all.
Right. Memory is fallible.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we know that because it's served wrong, done poorly for so many people who are wrongly convicted. And the idea that something kind of gets implanted in your mind because, you know, you hear some information, then you hear some other information somewhere else, and then you conflate the two and suddenly it's part of the narrative. Well, I think they did their first episode. This is their second episode. You know, this is what Rabia was talking about when she did her live that one time, where she was just like, you know, there's just a lot of stuff that for one reason or another we haven't really talked about, but like, F it.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
we're just going to put it all out there.
Yeah, and also, like, just to backtrack, you know, to put a button on the whole thing, it's still fascinating. And I love that we're, like, getting, because also, I love what they're doing where they're not just, like, only picking the things that, you know, that only fit a certain narrative or only fit a certain theory. They're, like, all of these things that have come in, that's what's being exposed on Undisclosed now. I think that's awesome. Also, new to me, I didn't realize.
Another chapter?
Did you know that?
No.
I didn't either.
I had to stop and listen back to it. I was like, did I hear what she just said?
Yeah. So there is coming this fall. They said there is when Robbie and I were talking yesterday. Yeah. She said there, because there's more stuff about Sellers, but it's going to be included in the fifth episode of the docuseries that's going to be coming out on HBO this fall. So yeah, super excited about that. And with that, I think we should go ahead and wrap this thing. We've just cleared an hour long one for us. Yeah. For having two questions this week.
That's right.
So, yeah, everybody, thanks for listening. Thanks for tuning in. And make sure listen on Sunday so you can hear the full story of what happened with Ed and what you can expect from this project that's coming out on A&E. And and we'll talk all about it in next week's follow-up. We'll talk to you guys then. Bye, guys.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music for Season 15 is created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @truthjusticepod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.